I feel bad I haven't spoken at all about the little history of this period of Italy. I thought I'll say a little bit about the Sforno.
Good, good.
When you open up a Mikraos Gedolos, standard Chumash that has more than Rashi, so one of the commentaries printed on the page is Rav Avadya Sforno, he lived in Italy between the 1400s and the 1500s, and he wrote his commentary on the Chumash. It's well known. He was a doctor for a living. Many of the Rabbonim in Italy were doctors. And many of them were involved in founding medical schools. Many of them used to teach in the medical schools. Today, the halacha is so complicated, so it's very difficult to be a doctor and a rebbe at the same time. There are people today who are doctors and rabbis and shuls also, and they learn, they teach there. But it's more difficult than it used to be then. So the Sforno, it's well known, the Sforno used to learn with non-Jewish theologians, non-Jewish people who are interested in Chumash. The Talmud has a din that one is not permitted to teach Torah to the non-Jews. It's a pasuk that we recite in the davening every day. The Pesukei Dezimra, Magid Dvarav LeYaakov Chukov V'Mishpotov LeYisrael, Hashem teaches the Torah to Bnei Yisrael, Lo Yoseh Hen Chovay, but to the other nations of the world, the Torah was not given. So the heter is, the Pesukim say in the Chumash that when Yeshua ben Nun is going to lead Bnei Yisrael to enter Eretz Yisrael, Moshe Rabbeinu was punished, he had to die in the Midbar, he wasn't going to cross over the Yarden, he's not going to lead Bnei Yisrael into Eretz Yisrael, but when Yeshua ben Nun leads Bnei Yisrael into Eretz Yisrael, so they were instructed that they take gigantic stones from the Yarden River and engrave all of the Torah. The question, what the whole Chamishul Chumshit Torah, or an abridged form of the Torah, something, and write it in translation in different languages so that all the nations of who live in Eretz Canaan will be able to see what it says in the Torah. So what happened to the Din? You're not allowed to teach Torah to the Nochrim. So the commentaries explain this. Rabbi Yesh has a famous essay about this. You're not permitted to teach Torah Shabal Peh to the Nochrim, the oral Torah. But the Pesukim and Chumash, that you're permitted to say. So let's say if a non-Jew comes and he asks me, what's the Jewish position on something about Shabbos, Kashas, whatever. So to say what it says in the Chumash, that's okay. But to say more, to enhance it and to explain everything, so that you should really avoid. We're not supposed to be teaching Torah Shabbat Peh to the Umas Ha'olam. So the Sforno is known for his commentary on Chumash. And every so often he has a comment that's really unusual. Just 2 weeks ago, I attended a Pidyon HaBen, which is pretty unusual. How many people have Pidyon HaBen? So I attended a Pidyon HaBen. So I was sitting next to the great-grandfather of the baby. We're from the same generation. We're having great-grandchildren. So the great-grandfather spoke, and he said over a comment from the Sforno on Chumash, which has not been accepted. The Sforno said the Sforno made a mistake over there. So in his commentary on Chumash, he writes that before you poda the baby, redeeming, Pidyon HaBen means that you're redeeming. What are you redeeming him? As if something is holy, as if something is Hekdesh, and you're not allowed to gain any, you're not allowed to use anything that belongs to Hekdesh. So if you poda the Hekdesh, if you give money to the Gizbar, then the Hekdesh goes L'chulin, then it loses the Kedusha. So Kozman, you didn't, if you have a firstborn baby boy, the baby has Kedusha, and the parents are not allowed to play with the baby until after they do the Pinyon HaBen. After they do the Pinyon, then the baby is Yotze L'chul. So there used to be a prominent rabbi in Cincinnati by the name of Rablazer Silver, as he would pronounce it, Rablazer Silver. And he wrote an encyclopedia, one-man encyclopedia, where he doesn't cover every single topic in halacha. A few topics he covers alphabetically arranged. So he writes about Pinyon HaBen, he quotes that the Sforno in his commentary on Chumash says this, and also the Maral Prague also has such a statement in one place. The Netziv, when he was a teenager, wrote a whole commentary on the Shiltis. Very surprising. Who people don't even realize how often the Shiltis is quoted in Tosfos and in the Shulchan Aruch. So the Netziv, Rabbi Berlin, he was the Rosh Hashiva Balozhin, the last 39 years before the Yeshiva in Balozhin was closed by the Russian government. as a teenager, as a young teenager, he wrote a commentary on the Shul. It's interesting that the person who later became his brother-in-law, the Aruch HaShulchan, married the sister of the Netziv, and their name was Berlin. So the Aruch HaShulchan writes that when he was young, he also wrote a commentary on the Shulchan. It was never printed. So it's interesting that the both people, I don't think they knew each other. I don't think they were friendly when they were youngsters. They both wrote the same period of time, both wrote commentaries on the same unusual sefer on the Shiltas. So the Netziv writes when he completed his whole commentary on the Shiltas, so he raised a question in his mind, does one recite the blessing of Shehechiyonu when you complete writing a sefer? So he says he's going to run through the Talmud to see what it says in the Gemara. So he starts quoting every single Gemara. But the Gemara discusses the topic of Shehechiyonu. When do you say Shehechiyonu? When do you not say Shehechiyonu? So in the middle of his whole, all of his quotations, he quotes the Gemara, the last few lines in Gemara Psochim. That the Gemara has a dispute when you have a Pinyin Rabben. Who says the Shehechiyonu? Should the Kohen say the Shehechiyonu because he's getting the money? Or should the father say the Shehechiyonu because he's fulfilling the mitzvah? Such a difference between this way, that way, very different. So the Netziv quotes from the Chasam Sofer and he thinks that it's correct. That really they both have to say Shehechiyonu. Both comments are correct. The father's fulfilling a mitzvah, that's a rare mitzvah, so you should say Shehechiyonu. And the Kohen is getting the money, the Kohen is also fulfilling the mitzvah. They both have to say Shehechiyonu. The Gemara's debate is, the Gemara's discussion is, you don't need two people saying the same bracha. Should the Kohen say to have a mind to be mitzi the father? Or should the father say to Shehechiyonu, have a mind to be mitzi the Kohen? But the truth of the matter is they both need Shehechiyonu. The debate was which one of the two should say to be mitzi the two of them. But then when he talks about that Gemara, about the Shehechiyonu, so he quotes this funny comment. He doesn't quote this Sfarno, but he quotes from the Maharal Prague and others that you're not allowed to play with your baby until after you do the Pinyin Avnet. So this is against the Beferish in Gemara. Gemara says at the end, that's where Rabbi Eliezer Silber points out in his Sefer. He quotes Achraidim who say that is not correct. And Sfarno is not correct on this. Gemara says Beferish, the Pinyin Aben, there's no Kedush on the baby. The Pinyin is not Matar any Yisur. It's just Achir, to give money to the guy. It's a mitzvah to give money to the guy. So that's a difficult Sfarno. But the Sfarno has a lot of times very fascinating comments. There's one comment that I say over every year, usually, Parshas Mezayis HaBracha, Moshe Rabbeinu, before he's about to die, gives a bracha to Bnei Yisrael. So where does the bracha begin? So those of you who remember, Mezayis HaBracha Sheberach Moshe, they start, Hashem Misinai Bo. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah HaSinai. That's not a bracha to the Jewish people, that's an introduction to the bracha. Afim Mihar Par Mehasa Merivas Kodesh, that's also an introduction. Then he says, Torah Tzivulana Moshe Rasha, that's also an introduction. So far there's no bracha. Then Moshe Rabbeinu finally gets around to giving brachas, so it says, Chi Ruvin Ba'al Yamos V'him Esav Mispar. So the Sforno said, that's not a bracha, that's a tefillah. If I say, you should live a long life, I say, B'losh Noichach, you should live, you should be healthy, you should have a good parnasa, you should get a good shidduch. When I speak to you, that's a bracha. When I speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chi Ruvein Va'al Yomos, Ruvein should have a long life and he shouldn't die. That's a tefillah, that's not a bracha. And he says, V'lelevi amat tumecho v'urecho. He's talking to God, tumecho urecho lishchas yidecho. He gave the Urim and Tumim to Shevet Levi. He's not talking to Levi. He's talking to the Rabbanu Shalom. So he said, that's not a bracha. So he claims, you go through the psukim in the beginning of the Zos HaBracha are an introduction to the bracha. Then you don't see a bracha by the Shvatim. He says the last pasuk in the bracha is the only pasuk that's a bracha, and it's a bracha to Eretz Yisrael. Barzal anachoshes min alecha, uchiyamecha d'alecha. Eretz Yisrael should be secure, and just like it's secure in the beginning, in the days of Yeshua ben Nun, that the enemy didn't come to attack, so too uchiyamecha d'alecha. Even years after Hakamas Hamedina, in the days of Yeshua ben Nun, Eretz Yisrael should always be secure. So that was, he claims that's the only pasuk that has a bracha. The last pasuk, Barzal Anachoshes Min Alecha, Uchiyamecha Devecha. That's an unusual an insight. And he refers to what he wrote in different places, that Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to cross over the Yarden. So he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu get angry at me, and he didn't let me enter Eretz Yisrael because of the fault of the Jewish people. So the Sfarim asked, what do you mean the fault of the Jewish people? And today said, it says Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to speak to the rock, and it's going to give water, and because he hit the rock, that's why he was punished. And Moshe and Aaron are both going to die in Chutzlot. They won't enter Eretz Yisrael. So what is he shifting the blame to Bnei Yisrael? So the Sfarim says, no. The Rebbeinu Shalom told Moshe Rabbeinu that before he dies, he's going to have to give a bracha to Eretz Yisrael. So the Sfarim explains, when Yaakov Avinu was about to die, and Yosef brought his two sons to Yaakov, that the grandfather should give them a bracha, so he says, Kochem no elai ba'avorchem, bring them closer to me. And he puts his hand on their heads. Why is that necessary? Because when you give a bracha, you have to say, B'loshen noichach, Kodesh Baruch Hu should give you hatzlocha, and so on. And the closer the person is, so the stronger the bracha will be. So Yaakov Avinu couldn't see, so he had to put his hands, bring them closer, and I'm going to put my hands. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted me to give a bracha to Eretz Yisrael before I die. So I said, Moshe Rabbeinu said to Rebbeinu Shalom, let me cross over the Yarden and I'll be close to, I'll be in Eretz Yisrael and I'll give a bracha to Eretz Yisrael. That'll be the bracha. Rebbeinu Shalom said, no, I don't want the bracha to be fulfilled. I'm going to punish Bnei Yisrael, I'm going to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, I'm going to send the Jewish people into Golus. That was already determined at the time of the Chet HaMeraglim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu got angry at me. He didn't allow me to enter Eretz Yisrael, even to give the bracha. Forget about to enter Eretz Yisrael, to live in Eretz Yisrael. That was Opgeret, that's my sin, that's my fault. But he didn't want me to enter Eretz Yisrael because he didn't want me to give a full bracha that should be fulfilled. That the Medina should be secure for many, many generations in the future. Very interesting insight. Very fascinating. There's another, those who learn Nidorim, there are people who don't know the first 25 plot in Nidorim, they don't know the last 65 plot in Nidorim, they just know one page in Nidorim. There's a Ran has the commentary on Nidorim. Ran took over the whole Masechta. You don't have to read the Gemara, you don't have to read the Rashi, just read the Ran. The Ran quotes the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Rashi and the Tosfos and the Ran. The Ran quotes everything. The Ran took over the whole Masechta. So the Ran quotes in the name of Balei HaTosfos an idea that's not accepted l'halacha. The Ran says that you don't have to pay taxes in Eretz Yisrael. Dina de Malchus HaDina doesn't apply in Eretz Yisrael. Why? What's the theory? The whole thing doesn't apply b'zman hazeh. But the Ran says like this, what's the theory behind the obligation to pay taxes? Why do you have to pay taxes in Great Britain, or in France, or in Italy? Because the country belongs to the king, and the king has a right to charge rent. See, today, the theory behind taxes is totally different. We're not paying taxes to enrich the king, or to enrich the president of the United States. He's doing work for us. Today we consider all the people who live in a community who have a shaychus with each other as shutfim. We all have certain needs. We need water purification. We need garbage collection. We need mail delivery. We need education for the children. And the majority of the people in New York need public schools. The religious Jews don't use the public schools, but if the majority of the people feel they need public schools, they have to have a public school system. So because we all share all of these needs together, some of them are taken care of on the municipal level, some of them are taken care of by the state government, some of them are taken care of by the federal government. Mail delivery is the federal government, and the highways, that's the state government, and so on. The garbage collection, that's the municipal government. So we shutfim on three levels. So whoever doesn't pay taxes is cheating from the other shutfim. So today the whole theory behind taxes is totally different. When you have a democracy, so the taxes are paid in order to cover all the expenses of the shutfis. It's not that you're stealing from the government, you're stealing from all the other citizens. I pay 10 times as much as I should on my taxes because there's so many people who are cheating on taxes. So it's not Gezel Akum that they're stealing from the government, they're stealing from all the other people. Everybody's taxes are higher because of those who are stealing, those who are cheating on taxes. But years ago, the purpose of the taxes was just to enrich the king. The king didn't really give any services for the taxes that he got. So the Ran on the door quotes in the name of Balei HaTosfos the country of England belongs to the King of England, so the king has a right to charge you rent. You want to live in his country. So instead of figuring out how much rent each person has to pay, so the king says, pay income tax. That'll take the place of the rent. France belongs to the King of France when there used to be a king, so he has a right to charge rent. Every country belongs to the king, so the king has a right to charge rent, and if you don't pay rent, you're living in his country without his permission. So it's Gesel, he's stealing from the king, because he's using his country without paying rent. Eretz belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu encouraged all the Jewish people, we should all live in Eretz Yisrael. So whoever is going to be governing Eretz Yisrael today doesn't apply, because the taxes are paid with Torah Shutfis. So this whole idea doesn't apply. And that's why in Shulchan Aruch, they don't even quote this Ran. They reject this whole idea. But the Ran quotes in the name of the Balei HaTosfos that since Eretz Yisrael belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the king, and he gave all the Jewish people permission, not only permission, he said he wants us all to live in Eretz Yisrael. So nobody has the right to charge taxes, because the obligation to pay taxes is you got to pay rent, because the king never gave permission. The king didn't give permission. So it's interesting, the Sfarad on Chumash has such a comment. And the Pasuk in the end of Chumash Vayikra, it says, if I have Steh Achuza, a field in Eretz Yisrael, that I got Birusha from my father, grandfather, all the way back to the days of Yishuv Benon, I got it Birusha. If I sell a field to someone else, then it's considered a Steh Mikneh by him. By me, it was a Steh Achuza. I have it Birusha by him. It's not a Steh Achuza. So when it comes Yom Kippur of the Jubilee year, the Sfarad Chosu is Balei of the Yovel. The one who has it as a stay mikna has to give back the field to the one who originally owned it as a Yerusha, that it should revert back to become a stay achuza. So then the Chumash says, "V'ha'aretz lo simacha litzmisus." The owner of the field who wants to sell his farm, his house, to someone else, is not permitted to sell a house lachalutin. He can't sell a house. I'm selling you the house for the next 500 years. That's a violation of the din. You have to sell a house and explain when it comes. Yom Kippur Shal Yovel. Sometimes it'll be very close. Yovel is every 50th year, so sometimes the next year is already Yom Kippur Shal Yovel. Sometimes you have another 49 years to go. So the Torah says, "Vatz lasim machal etzmisus kili kol ha'aretz." So I always thought Pashup Shat kili kol ha'aretz. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the balabos over the whole world. So this Torah says kili kol ha'aretz, no, because Eretz Yisrael belongs to the Ribbono Shel Olam. I would have said otherwise, but he says no. The pasuk only goes on Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Lo Simochal Etzmisa doesn't apply to Chutz Lartz; only applies to Eretz Yisrael. This one has a lot of very original interpretations, but every so often he's going to say something that's against the Gemara, so you have to keep your eyes open.
Good evening, everybody. On Shabbos, starting a bit of a discussion with the women. So I mentioned that we have the mitzvah, well, halachta v'drocha, to imitate the ways of God. So that poses a problem, it poses a question. Is God preparing to retire and we're going to take over? Why should we imitate the ways of God? A little boy sometimes imitates a doctor. He takes your pulse and he takes your blood pressure, whatever. He checks you out. He makes believe that he's a doctor. Someday he may become a doctor. A little girl imitates a mommy. She puts on a big bonnet and she puts on high heels. And she screams at the children. They think that that's a definition of a mommy. Someday she will be a mommy, probably. But why should we imitate the ways of God? So if you read the Pesukim carefully, we mentioned on Shabbos, the Vilna Gaon explains Pshat and the Pesukim, because we were all created with Tzelem Elokim. When we were born, Mishnah says, Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem, and most of the Mefarshim understand all human beings were created B'Tzelem Elokim. B'nai Yisrael, Avonim Lamok, and we have like the DNA. It's a deeper degree of Tzelem Elokim. But everybody has a Tzelem Elokim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructs us, B'alach T'Bedrochav, to go in the ways of God to preserve the Tzelem Elokim. So that's how the next pasuk continues. When all the nations of the world will see Kishem Hashem Dikra Lecha, that the Jewish people have succeeded in preserving that Tzelem Elokim, and the Umasoilim also created the Tzelem Elokim, the Yoram in Mecca, they will learn from us how they can lead their life based on Yir HaShemayim. The Yoram in Mecca, they learn from us how they can lead a life of Yirat Shamayim. So one of the midas of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, one of the attributes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we're supposed to imitate is HaKadosh Baruch Hu is described by the Navi Yeshaya as a kel mistater. He hides. We don't need the Navi Yeshaya to tell us that. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is invisible, and he does such a good job of hiding. There's so many apikursim who don't even believe that he exists. But our nation, on the occasion of Yetzias Mitzrayim and Maamar Hasinu, we had 7 million people witness all the Esa Makkos and Kriyas Yamsuf and Maamar Hasinu. So we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a kel mistater. He does everything bitzina, not befrahesya, privately. He's very private. So part of our preserving the Tzelem Elokim, that we should lead a private life. So the Mesillas Yesharim, written by Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, he lived in Italy for many years until they gave him such a hard time because he was teaching Kabbalah to the university, to the medical students who went to medical school. So they gave him such a hard time, he ran away. They gave him such sores, he ran away to Amsterdam for a few years. And then that's where he wrote the Mesillas Yesharim. And then he moved to Eretz Yisrael, and he died there he died younger than 40. And his sefer is such a popular sefer. Everybody reads the Mesillas Yesharim. So the Mesillas Yesharim speaks about people who come into shul, and they want everybody to know that they're here. So some people walk up all the way to the front of the shul. Everybody should know that they're here. Other people walk all the way to the back of the shul. Not out of humility. Everyone should see that they're here, that they're doing something different from everybody else. Somebody gets an aliyah, so someone will scream the brachas out loud. Everybody should know that he's here. The other person will whisper the brachas. Everybody should know that he's different from everybody else. And the Torah wants us to lead a life of bitzina, not bifrahesia. That's what tznius is all about. People make a mistake. They think that tznius only has to do with dressing. And it only has to do with women, women's dressing. Tznius is a mitzvah, men and women. That's a mitzvah of halachta bedrachov. And tznius means to lead a life of bitzina, as opposed to befrahesia. Everyone should lead as much as possible a private life. So some things you can't do bitzina. A government has to have a melech. A community has to have a rabbi. You have to have a chazan. You have to have a mayor of the city. You have to have a chief of police. So the rabbis commented on the pasuk, "Som tosim alecha melech." You have to appoint a king, melech v'lo malka. It's bad enough that the men have to compromise on their tznius. We don't want the women to have to compromise on their tznius. They should try to be tzonua. They should avoid being appointed to the head of any organizations. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to always say that it's not proper for a shul to appoint a woman as a president, because that's a violation of Sorora, that based on the Pasuk, Melech Veloy Malko. That's how the Tanoim commented, that women shouldn't take public positions. If the best person for the job to be president of the shul is a woman, so you have no choice, you have to appoint a woman. But if you can appoint either a man or a woman, that's not right to appoint a woman. There was one of the shuls in New Jersey had that two people were candidates for president. There was an election coming up. So the man who was a candidate for presidency, he was running on the policy. He wanted to fire the rabbi who was Orthodox and hire a conservative rabbi and change the whole shul. And the woman who was running for president wanted to maintain the rabbi and to keep the Orthodox standard of the shul. So the rabbi knew that there's a shaila where they're allowed to have a woman be president of the shul. So the rabbi didn't want to ask any of the rabbis in YU, we're so right-wing, so he had to call up Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein in there. He says, Rabbi Lichtenstein, of course you appoint the woman under the... If you would ask any rabbi in the yeshiva, they would have said the same thing. You didn't have to go to ask somebody in Eretz Yisrael. Obvious like that. That's the idea of tznius, to try to do everything bitzina as opposed to bifarhesia. The Medrash writes that the Luchas Rishonas, the first said of Aseres HaDibros, that Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai with the two Shnei Luchos HaBris, with the two stones that the Aseres HaDibros engraved on them. So the first Luchos were broken, then Moshe Rabbeinu had to bring stones up from this earth to Har Sinai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu engraved them. and the second luchas were not broken. So the Medrash comments, how come the first luchas were broken, the second luchas not? Because the first luchas were given with such fanfare, all of the birds stopped chirping, and all the animals stopped making noise, and the whole world knew that something is happening. So because the luchas rishonis were given b'frahesia with such fanfare, because of rokim it was so noisy, so that's why sholta behem ein hara, and ein hara set in, and they were broken. And the luchas shnias, Moshe Rabbeinu came down quietly on Yom Kippur with the second set of luchas, and there was no big tumult. So that's why the second luchas were not ein hara was not shirli. Then the Medrash ends off the concluding line, holamadato. The moral of the story is, Shein lucha yochem and atzniyus. Best thing is to do everything but zinner. People don't realize that tzniyus just means to lead a life of privacy, to be quiet, not to dress differently from everybody else, not to scream out loud, not to whisper, to dress and to talk in a normal fashion, not in order to draw attention to oneself. So that's what the halacha says, that even when you do have to compromise on tzniyus sometimes, you have to have a mayor, you have to have a president of a shul, you have to have a rabbi. It's bad enough that the men have to compromise on their tzniyus. We don't want the women to have to compromise. So that was the next step after what we spoke about on Shabbos. That was the next step after that. I wanted to speak a little bit more about the rabbonim here in Italy. And if you look at a lot of svarim, they'll talk about, we mentioned there was a sefer Shiboli Aleket. That was a big sefer Psak Halacha. If you look in Shulchan Aruch HaRachayim, every other page they quote something from the Shibboleth HaLeket. It's one of the sources. It's a likut of Gaonim and Rishonim, and he has long discussions of things. So they always in the recent Sforim they always refer to the author of the Shibboleth HaLeket as Rabbi Tzidkio HaRofe. So I didn't realize until I was preparing for this tour that that's a mistake. On the first page in the Sefer, it says the author's name is Tzidkio ben Avraham HaRofe. So in the Sforim, they thought that the rabbi who wrote the Sefer was a doctor. Many of the rabbanim in Italy were doctors. That's what we spoke about. Yes, many of them were doctors, but the author of Shabbat Aleka was not. His father was a doctor, but he himself was not a doctor. But we have from other sources that Rabbi Avraham, the father, was a doctor, but Tzidkio, the author, was not a doctor. In the late 1400s, early 1500s, there was a Talmid Chacham who lived in Italy, whose name was Yeshua Boaz, and he did us a tremendous service. In the Gemara, he wrote, Da'im Mishpat Ner Mitzvah. Whenever you learn a Gemara, so you have a different opinion, so he'll always put a letter, Aleph Beis Gimel, a letter on that line in the Gemara where the Halacha has been accepted like that opinion. I'll tell you where you can find the Psak Halacha in the Shulchan Aruch and in the Rambam and in the Smag. The Smag used to be a safer Psak Halacha in the days of the Rishonim. Used to use today, hardly anybody looks in the Smag. But that work was done by Rabbi Yeshua Boaz. Then every time the Gemara quotes a pasuk from Tanakh, he'll tell you which chapter, which book it's in Tanakh, which chapter it is. Unfortunately, the chapters in Tanakh were worked out by the Christian scholars. It doesn't correspond to our tradition at all. There were traditions about where the chapters of Karta Masor, where the chapters should end. But Rabbi Shua Boaz, because so many Bibles were printed already and had the chapters according to the Catholic, according to the Christian division, so he wrote the Marmakimus based on the available biblical text. Then he's the one who did the Masoras HaShas, the cross-references, wherever this Gemara appears somewhere else, he tells you where it is. And then on the margin, on the side of the Rif, in the back of the Gemara, they print the Rif, on the side, he wrote the Shilti Giborim. So the Shilti Giborim is a collection of different opinions from Rishonim, and once in a while, he'll give his own opinion. He very often will quote the Piskei Riaz. He spoke about that. There was a Tosis Rid, Rabbi Yishaya HaRishon, who was an earlier Rishon. He corresponded with Maharam Rutenberg. They lived in the same generation. And then this Rabbi Yishaya Ditrani had a grandson who was his most outstanding student. His name was Rabbi Yishaya Achman. He named the grandchildren after the grandfather. So
So the grandson's name is also Rabbein Yishai. So the Rashi Tevos, the acronym for the grandson is Riaz, Rabbein Yishai Achron Zal. So we mentioned yesterday, I think, not to be confused with Rabbein Yitzchok Arzarua, who lived in Vienna. He was also in the same generation. The Arzarua used to correspond with the Maharam Rutenberg. And the Tosfos Rid, the grandfather, used to correspond with the Maharam Rutenberg. So the grandson of the Tosfos Rid, Riaz, is very often quoted in the Shulta Gibbar. So this is a tremendous assistance in learning Gemara. The Ay Mishpat Der Mitzvah, he saves you the time of finding the Rambam on your own. He tells you where the din is found in Shulchan Aruch and in the Rambam. He gives you the cross references to the other Gemaras, and he gives you the references to Tanakh. That's fantastic. Shulta Gibbarim, some people use it, some people don't use it. Not only does he quote from earlier poskim in the Shulta Gibbarim, every so often he has his own opinion, and his opinion is always discussed. He discusses it seriously. When Rabbi Soloveitchik first came to America, my father was a bocher, and he was learning in yeshivas of Yitzchok Gochan under Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik. So Moshe Soloveitchik was so excited that his son Rabbi Yosher Ber was coming to America. So he requested of all of the students in his class, there weren't so many, yeshiva was very small then, requested of all the students they should come to the dock to greet his son. So they all came to greet him when he arrived. He was already married and he had a baby from Europe. And in front of all the students, he told his son, Rabbi Yosher Ber, he would like him to give a shiur tomorrow in the yeshiva. The first shiur in America. So the first shiur that he gave in America was on the topic of Chazaras HaShatz. What motivated the Chachamim to introduce Chazaras HaShatz after everybody finishes davening softly, Tefillin Belachash, then the Chazar repeats the Shemoneh Esrei out loud. So the motivation to introduce Chazaras HaShatz, repetition of the Shemoneh Esrei, was that in the days of the Tanoim, the text of the Siddur was not printed because it was considered part of Torah Shabbat Peh, and it wasn't proper to write down Torah Shabbat Peh. So there were many people who didn't know how to daven. How are they going to know how to daven if there's no siddur? So they needed to introduce Chazaras HaShatz to be motzi de'ein aboki, to be able to daven on behalf of those people who don't know how to daven Shmoneh Esrei on their own. So Rabbi Soloveitchik explained that although that was the motivation to introduce the Chazaras HaShatz in the beginning, but once they introduced it, it takes on a life of its own. And even if everybody in the shul is a baki, there's a certain young Talmid Chacham in Eretz Yisrael has his own yeshiva. He did away with the Chazaras HaShatz. Why? He's smarter than everybody else in the world. He decided his yeshiva, everybody knows how to daven, everybody has a siddur, so we don't need Chazaras HaShatz. So that's Rabbi Soloveitchik a few years before him. This just happened recently. Soloveitchik, when he first came to America, spoke about that issue. So he said, what motivated the Chachamim in the first place to introduce repetition in Shemoneh Esrei? Because there were many people who didn't know how to daven on their own. But once they introduced it, it takes on a life of its own. There's a Tfilas HaYochid and there's a Tfilas HaTzibur. The Yochid davens, Tfilas Balachish, that's each individual davens. We recommend they should daven Tfilas BitZibur. If you have 10 people davening together, you stand a better chance of having your prayers accepted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But then you have that Tfilas HaTzibur. The whole Tzibur should offer together one Shemoneh Esrei, that's the Chazaras HaShatz. Even though everybody already davened the Tefillah Belachash, everybody already davened the Tefillah Sayachid, the people who davened already are obligated to listen to every word of Chazaras HaShatz. It's not right, says the Shulchan Aruch, it's not right that people are learning, they're being Mavisedra, they're learning another psalm, when the Chazar is repeating the Shemoneh Esrei. Remember, for a few years I used to daven in the Agudah in Washington Heights. It was a big Talmid Chacham who learned Baruch Moshe Feinstein many years. So he used to stand next to the chazan with a big minchas chinuch. They don't have any small minchas, and with a gigantic minchas chinuch open. He was always looking in the minchas chinuch during Chazaras HaShatz. So it's in Shulchan Aruch that that's not permissible. Everybody's going to see that he's looking in minchas chinuch, and no one's going to pay attention to Chazaras HaShatz. Everybody has to pay attention. Even though we already davened Tfilas HaYochid, you have to daven Tfilas HaTzibur. Tzibur together offers one Shemoneh Esrei. So this Chiddush is pointed out by the Yeshua Boaz in his commentary on the side of the Rif and the Shulta Gibbarim in the end of Maseches Rosh Hashanah, when the Gemara talks about Chazaras HaShatz. Rabbi Yeshua Boaz's comments are quoted by the Ramah. The Ramah lived a little after him. I'm surprised that he had the Sefer of Elul. Ramo lived in Poland, and this Sefer was written in Italy, and he had access to it within 30 years or so. So the Ramo quotes the comment made by the Shilti Gevorim regarding tying knots on Shabbos. Let's say you tie your shoelaces, so you're afraid the shoelaces are going to untie, so you want to make a double knot. So strictly speaking, even if you make a double knot, but you plan to untie the knot within 24 hours, you're going to untie the knot when you go to sleep. And so I'm not going to wear your shoes when you go to sleep. So the Shilti Gevorim came up with a minhag. He says, not a din. You should always avoid, whenever possible, you should always avoid making a double knot. If you have little children and you're going to keep on little babies, they always untie their shoelaces. And then you've got to be tying their shoelaces every 5 minutes. So then the minhag doesn't apply. Or if a person has such shoelaces that even an adult, they're going to untie all the time. So we don't have the minhag. But the Shilti Gevorim quotes such a minhag that one should avoid making a double knot, even though strictly speaking it's permissible because it's aroi legambre, kesher shel kayama, zenisa deraisa, kesher sheino shel kayama, zenisa derabbanan. But if it's aroi daroi, it's very aroi, then it's mutarit madrabbanan. So there are more quotes this from the Hagbohas Alfasin, the comments on the side of the rift. That's what we know, that's what we call the Shilti Gevorim. Shilti Gevorim is also quoted in Shulchan Aruch. If a person moves there to Israel to live there permanently, that's a mitzvah based on Sukkah and Homs. There's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. Is there a mitzvah to visit Eretz Yisrael if you plan to move back to Chutzal Arts? So the Magen Avraham quotes that that's a machloikis. And Shulchan Aruch, they write that one shouldn't go, it's a question whether the din still applies today, one shouldn't go on a boat trip on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday for various reasons. It could be the whole din doesn't apply today, it could be none of the reasons apply. But that's the din starts off in the Gemara. You shouldn't go on a boat trip Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, unless you're going l'dvar mitzvah. So what constitutes a dvar mitzvah? So if a person is moving to Eretz Yisrael, that's considered a dvar mitzvah. So the Magen Avraham, in his commentary on the side of the page, quotes a dispute among the Achrayim. What if one is going to tour Eretz Yisrael, is going to visit, plans to move back to Chutz Lords? So some are of the opinion that's also a partial kiyumah mitzvah. The mitzvah bishul mitzvah is to live in Eretz Yisrael permanently and to visit Eretz Yisrael. So some are of the opinion, if you walk Dalar Amas in Eretz, if you walk 4 Amas in Eretz, that's already a partial kiyumah mitzvah. Others say only if you stay in Eretz for a minimum of 30 days. So if you can make your ticket either slightly less than 30 days, slightly more than 30 days, so you should try to make it slightly more than 30 days. Then there's a third opinion, there's only a partial kiyumah mitzvah if you live in Eretz Yisrael for over Yud Beis Chodesh, a whole year. Sometimes the Gemara in Bava Basra has dinim that depend on living in the city for 30 days. Sometimes the dinim deraisa that depend on living in the city for 12 months. So the two opinions play out over here. So there are different opinions. So the Shilti Gevorim writes, when he talks about this issue, Shilti Gevorim's on the opinion that visiting Eretz Yisrael is not a mitzvah at all. It's only a mitzvah if you move to Eretz Yisrael to live there permanently. If you're only going to tour, his own opinion is not considered a kiyumah mitzvah. And you would have an issue whether you're allowed to go by boat Wednesday, Thursday, Friday before Shabbos. There's another famous Shilti Gevorim which is debated significantly. There is a din that a Kohen is not permitted to go to a cemetery. He's not allowed to be Metami L'Meis. What if the Kohen was already Metami to a Meis today? One of his 7 relatives died and there's a mitzvah that the Kohen should participate in the funeral. Lo Yitamo, the Pasuk says in Parshas Emor, Kohanim are obligated to be metami when one of the 7 relatives dies. So let's say the Kohen was metami to a mace in the morning, one of the 7 relatives. Then the afternoon, somebody else dies. So is he permitted to attend that funeral or not? So that's a dispute in the Gemara. And that's a dispute between the Rambam and the Raivad and the Paskim. So the Rambam says, even though he's not, in today's seven chukas, it says, that when a person was in contact with a mace, a person attended a funeral, he has to have, somebody should sprinkle paraduma water on him, not before the 3rd day, after he was in contact with the mace. Let's say a person attended a funeral on Monday, so Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, so the first time you have paraduma water sprinkled on you should be on Wednesday, and then 4 days later is going to be on Sunday. If he touched the mace on Monday, if he came in contact on Monday, so the 7th day will be next week on Sunday. They need hazar shlishi shvi with varadum the water, and then the person is now eligible. He can go to mikveh to become tohar. So the Rambam is of the opinion that even though the person attended a funeral, the kohen attended a funeral in the morning, but he's attending another funeral in the afternoon on the same day, is not extending the days that he has to wait till he's going to become tohar. He's not really being ma'asev tum al timasa. He's not adding on anything more. Still, the Rambam thinks that it's a biblical prohibition. He's not allowed to. The Rabbi disagrees. Says no, since he's not being ma'asev tum al timasa, his understanding of the Gemara. It's a dispute between the Rambam and the Rabbi how to read the Gemara. So he says since you're not adding any additional tumah, that's permissible. That's how some read the Rabbi. That's permissible. So the Shilti Gibarim in Masechet Shavuos writes a very fascinating chiddush, which has not really been accepted. He says that today, since we don't have paradume ashes available anywhere in the world, so even if the kohen only attended his father's funeral 6 years ago, and he hasn't been in the funeral since, but you can't say that he's being moisav tum al tumasai by going to a funeral today, because we don't have any paradume ashes. He can't become Torah today. He's not extending the tum at all. So according to the Rabbi, that would be permissible. So others disagree. They say, no, but theoretically, if ashes would have been available, is extending. So that's a chiddush. Shilti Gibarim thinks he's not really adding on anything over here. See, he lived in the late, this Rabbi Shua Boaz is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam quotes him. And we use his Sfarim every day. We use his Torah Or, his cross-references to the Tanakh, and his Masoros HaShas. And his Ein Mishpat Der Mitzvah, we use his Shilti Gibarim as well, and his notes on the side of the Rif. A few years after him, the Ramah, who quotes Rabbi Shua Boaz, the Ramah had a relative who lived in Padua, in Italy. Maharam, he was Reb Meir of Padua. He was not a Sephardi at all. His name is Katzenallenbogen. That's a dead giveaway. Katzenallenbogen is a city in Germany. He was an Ashkenazi, absolutely Ashkenazi, but somehow he got a Rabbonis in Padua. So he has a collection of Shalos HaTshuvos. He's known for the following. He went b'shutfis with a non-Jew. They had Hebrew printing presses here. I mentioned yesterday, I think, that Yosef Kara, who lived in Tzfat in the mid-1500s, sent his Sefer Beis Yosef on the tour. He sent the Sefer to the Ramah Mifaru that he should print it for him. And he printed it from his own money. The Ramah Mifaru paid for the whole printing on his own. So the Maharam Padua, Rav Meir Katzenallenbogen, the relative of the Ramah, went into Shutfis with the Nochri to reprint the edition of the Rambam. And he added on here and there. Every three pages, there's a tiny little footnote on the bottom of the page that if you ask any student in the yeshiva, they never even notice that there's anything there. We know that you have the Magen Mishnah and the Kesem Mishnah and the Lechem Mishnah, Mishnah Melech, all the different commentaries. But that on every three pages, there's one word, a correction of one word. In the Venice edition, it has a different girsa, a different reading. None of the yeshiva boys even notice that there's anything there. So the Maharam Padua added his hagoyas, his corrections, on the bottom of the page. And he was b'shutfis, but the Nochri, they were selling this Rambam. So another non-Jewish printer realized he can make money by making a new edition of the Rambam. People need an edition. So he decided he's going to print the Rambam also. There wasn't a copyright. The Rambam had already died centuries before. So he printed another edition of the Rambam. He was selling it for less than the Maharam Padua's edition. So the Maharam Padua, who lived in Italy, in Padua, sent a letter to his relative, the Ramah, who lived in Krakow, in Poland, could you please write a tshuva to support my business, to support the fact, encouraging all the people they should buy my edition of the Rambam, instead of buying the less expensive edition that the other Nochri printed. So the Ramah wrote a whole tshuva. I'm always very surprised. He doesn't mention one word that he's related to the Maharam Padua. I thought that was a little unfair. He should have said that it's his relative. He doesn't write, unless maybe everybody knew that they were related. I don't know. So he gives a whole bunch of reasons why no one is allowed to buy the new edition. So one reason is, whenever you can buy something from a Yisrael or from a Nachri, so the Gemara in Bava Metzia learns out from a pasuk, b'chistimker or nimker, if you want to sell something, it should be la misecho. Rather than sell to a Nachri, sell to a Yehudi. Okay, no, if you want to buy something, so buy miyad misecho, buy from a Yisrael. If you have a drugstore in the neighborhood that's owned by Yisrael, and another drugstore owned by Nachri, so you should buy by this, even if it'll cost a little bit more. But if you have a grocery store that a Yehudi has, even though he charges a little bit more than the AMP, so if it's not that much more, so it's preferable to give the business to the Yehudi. So that's the first thing he says, that everyone should buy the Maram Paro's edition of the Rambam to give Parnasa to the Maram Paro. Then he has another din. You're not allowed to have a sefer Sheina Muge in the house. If you have a sefer that has mistakes printed in it, you're not allowed to keep it around the house because you may paskin incorrectly, you may follow the wrong psak. So he says all of the other editions, the non-Jew, the second non-Jew who printed his own edition of the Rambam, didn't print the Hagos of the Maram Paro. So the Ramah says all the other editions of the Rambam are considered sefer Sheina Muge. They're Rambams with mistakes. And you're not allowed to use them, period. You have to use Dafka, the corrected edition of the Maram Paro. That's a bit of a joke, because today, if you ask any boy in the yeshiva, they don't even know that there is such a thing as Hagos on the bottom of the page. You never look at those corrections at all. That's very humorous. And then he has around 6-7 reasons why all the people have to buy the edition of the Maram Paro. But he has another reason that's very, very problematic. He says, one of the Sheva Mitzvahs, B'nei Noyach, is dinim. What does it mean, dinim? So he claims that the Ramban on Chumash in Parshas Vayishlach seems to say, this is hard to believe, the Ramban on Chumash seems to say that the non-Jews have to observe dinim, all of the 24 of us nezikin. The first Mishnah in Bava Kamma says that there are 4 of us nezikin, Shor Bar Mabehever, then the Gemara says there are 13 of us nezikin, then the Gemara finally says there are 24 of us nezikin. So the Ramban is tshuva, quotes from the Ramban in his commentary on Chumash, that the Nochem have to observe dinim, all of the 24 of his nezikim. The Pashtus is that the Ramban never said that, and it seems to be against the Gemara. But then he says, not only do the Nochem have to observe all the 24 of his nezikim, they have to observe every single din that is printed in the Choshen Mishpat. So since in Choshen Mishpat, the Shulchan Aruch quotes the din, that if a Talmid Chacham, let's say there's years ago, there used to be traveling peddlers. They used to come to a community and sell cosmetics for the women. Full of brush men. They used to sell toothpaste, toothbrushes, all got combs, all kinds of shmachtas, all kinds of junk. So if you have a Talmid Chacham and a Balabas, both come to town to sell their wares. So first you have to give the Talmid Chacham the right to sell out as much as he wants to. Because if he's going to have some extra time, he's going to be sitting and learning. And then after he sells all he wants to sell, then you give permission to the other person. He can sell what he wants to sell. So the Ramah says that the Nachrim are obligated to observe that din also. Why? That's a din to see to it that there should be more learning in Kalam Yisrael. He said, but the din is printed in Choshen Mishpat, so the non-Jews have to observe every single din that's in Choshen Mishpat. Even though this din is not din, it's a din that everybody, all Jewish people, should support Levin HaTorah. Very surprising tshuva. Anyway, that's famous, that the Ramah, in his collection of tshuvas, wrote this tshuva to support his relative, the Maram Padua. In Padua, it wasn't the only city in Italy, there were several medical schools. In Padua there was a famous medical school. They were the first ones to allow Jews to attend their medical school. So the Jews were very excited about that, having the COVID of going to medical school in Padua. But then an issue came up that one of the teachers, one of the professors in the Padua medical school introduced a new Einfall that all of the candidates who are learning medicine should take a course in anatomy. They should dissect a cadaver in order to learn what the organs are all about in the body. So this is not permissible to do that on a Jewish body. First of all, it's in violation of Kavati Berenah Bayom Ahu. In And secondly, a mace, Yisrael, a Jewish mace, is also about Noah. And he said, you're not allowed to do that. So the medical school in Padua required, it became so popular, that's where it started in Padua, I think, that they have to study anatomy by dissecting a cadaver. At that time, they didn't have every student have his own cadaver. The professor would dissect in front of all the students. But they required of all of the students that whatever city they came from, they should see to it that that city should donate one cadaver so they'll have for next year, the year after, and so on. So the Jews said, we can't donate any cadavers. It's against the Jewish law. So this was an issue going on for years and years and years. The Italian government, the required of the Jewish community that they have to pay a fortune of money because they were not giving any cadavers because it's against the Jewish law. They required of them, if we want to continue to send Jewish students to the medical school, they have to pay a fortune of money. So every couple of years, they would ask them to pay more money and more money. And they always paid the money because they wanted to have their children have the opportunity of going to medical school. It's interesting, several years ago, I think 6-7 years ago, a Swedish scholar put out a book about all the different rabbonim who came from Italy. So I was looking through the book the last couple of months. So I saw among the various names they have, Emmanuel Haromi. Emmanuel Haromi lived in the 1200s in Rome. He was not a rabbi, he was a shengetz. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch in Hilchas Shabbos, they say you're not allowed to read novels by Emmanuel Haromi on Shabbos because it's Divrei Chol, and you're not allowed to read it the rest of the week either because it's Dvarim B'Tehillim, and it's terrible. He makes fun of the Ravid all the time. He liked the Rambam and he didn't like the Ravid, so he makes fun of the Rebbe. Next one of the Rishon that he didn't like. He lived in the days of the Rishon. So Emmanuel Haromi was not from the prominent Rabbonim in Rome. He was considered a shegetz. And he went down in history, Lideroen, to the Darussalam, because Rabbi Yisrael Karov, you shouldn't look in his books even on the weekdays. And it's interesting, they quote at the end of the davening a lot of times on Friday night and Leil Yontif. And a lot of shuls, they'll sing Yigdal, where we were in Florence on the first Shabbos. Oh, there is no second Shabbos.
Yeah, I know, I couldn't afford it.
On Leil Shabbos, they ended off the davening with the Yigdal. And they have an additional two lines at the end of Yigdal. And these are the 13 principles of faith of Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon that our religion is based on. So they quote from the Arizal. The Arizal lived in the 1500s in Tzfat and Eretz Yisrael. He said, it's not permissible, it's not proper to sing Yigdal. If you want to sing something, you should sing Adon Olam. Sing, so Rabbi Soloveitchik explained what's wrong with singing Yigdal. So he thought that the reason why the Arizal was opposed, because this is Chukas Hakom. They picked this up from the Christians. In the Jewish religion, we don't recite our catechism, we don't recite what our religion is based on. Many people, after they finish davening shacharis, they say the 13 animamins quietly, but the tzibur doesn't say it's part of the prayer service. By the Catholics, that's part of the prayer service. They repeat, bal peh, what their animamins are. So Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that was the reason for the Arizal, that you shouldn't sing Yigdal, because Yigdal is picked up for the whole idea. To incorporate into the prayer services what the Ikori Hamunah are, they picked up from the Catholics, that's why it's not proper. So Rabbi David Cohen from Flatbush, very big Talmid Chacham, he's a Refuah Shleima. So he wrote quite a few svarim on Siddur. Has very interesting comments. All the svarim are very fascinating. He's a super genius. He learned at Chaim Berlin for many years. So he has a different suggestion. He thinks that perhaps the reason why the Arizal was opposed to Yigdal, he thinks that it was written by Emmanuel Haromi. This shegetz whom the Shulchan Aruch singles out. So Rabbanim corresponded with him and he said, it's not true. Yigdal was already recited before Emmanuel Haromi's time. It preceded him. So Rabbi Rabbi Cohen thinks that still, he thinks that Emmanuel Haromi touched it up. He thinks that the edition that we have, the version that we have, the Mahadura that we recite of Yigdal, was touched up by Emmanuel Haromi, and that's why the Arizal was opposed. That's a question. But they were opposed to Emmanuel Haromi. He doesn't really belong in the list, if you have a book about the Talmid Chacham in Italy, he doesn't belong there at all. Okay, we'll have to continue with some more tomorrow.
Okay, now we're going to hear from the Rosh Yeshiva himself, a little Dvar Torah.
First, I want to thank everybody. It was a very pleasant summer, a very pleasant week that we spent together. We're drinking L'chaim here with the Italian wine. Reminds one of the tshuva of the Ramah. I remember when I was a student in the yeshiva, so Rabbi Soloveitchik was all upset that he always used to read, the Yiddish newspaper used to be a daily, then it became a weekly, and then it disappeared already. So at the time that it was a daily, so they carried an article that the Vad HaRabbonim of the conservative rabbinate, or Kipaskin, that you're permitted to drink wine that's processed by Nachrim because it's a Tshuvas HaRamah. So Rabbi Soloveitchik was all upset. We didn't read the Yiddish newspaper. We didn't know what he was talking about. So he mentioned in class, we should look in the Ramah's Tshuva. The Ramah has the following. The Ramah lived in Krakow in Poland. And in Poland, the religious Jews didn't make their own wine. They used to buy wine that was processed in Italy. And the Jews in Italy who owned the wineries, they themselves used to drink Goyisha wine. So the Ramah was asked to Shaila, how can we rely on the kashrus of the wine? The Mishnah Bechera says, Achoshel al adov al adonav al amihidon. Eidech adem bisum, we believe a person, if the person keeps kosher, he's believed to say that his food is kosher. If the woman observes Taras HaMishpacha, she's believed to say that the mikveh is kosher, and that the woman went under the mikveh and all the hair went under. But if the woman doesn't observe kashrus because she doesn't observe Taras HaMishpacha, then she doesn't have the manis in the area of the mikveh. If a person observes Taras HaMishpacha and doesn't observe kashrus, they don't have the manis, they can't be trusted in the area of kashrus. Whatever you don't observe, you don't have nemanis. You can't be trusted in that area. So how can we drink the wine that's manufactured by the Jews, the religious Jews in Italy? They themselves said to drink Goyisha wine. How can we trust them? So the Ramah writes, they make a mistake. Apparently in the 1500s, all the water in Italy was polluted and it wasn't possible to drink water. But you have to drink water and they have to drink something in the middle of the deal. So he used to drink Goyisha wine. Just like we're not permitted to eat pas nochrim, bread that's baked by nochrim, or bishon nochrim, you're not allowed to eat the food that's cooked by nochrim. So pas, the pasuk in Chumash has a pasuk, lo al alechem la adon yichya ha'odam. Man doesn't live on bread alone. But the Rishonim paraphrased the pasuk, they said, al alechem yichya ha'odam. Bread was the main staple of the meal. Years ago, it's not like today. Everybody's on a diet, and on Shabbos, you wash your hamotzi, you just eat a little bit, and the whole meal is way more than the bread. Years ago, when I was a little child, all the Europeans used to eat. A meal consisted of 8 slices of bread, a little bit of chicken, a little bit of kugel, whatever. But the main course in the meal was the 8 slices of bread. So since Allah lechem yichya ha'adam, so that's why in the Gemara you have this kula that if it's pas palter, if the nochri who bakes the bread is not my next door neighbor, he's not a private person, he bakes bread for the whole community, he's a baker for the community. So the whole prohibition of eating pas nochri is because we're afraid that I may marry his daughter, I may be interested in having a lifetime supply of this delicious bread. So since he bakes bread for the whole community, so Mustama, one of the Nachim, will marry his daughter. Why should you be concerned that I'm going to marry his daughter? So because of the Ramah rights, because the water was polluted in Italy, and you have to drink something in the middle of the meal, and you have to drink something, so it's just like al alechem yichya ha'adam, so the wine was considered chayei nefesh. So the Balabatim in Italy talked it into themselves. The Ramah says that it's not correct. So Yom Zechai Geret, they talked it into themselves. That just like paspalter is mutter, so the stam yeinim is also mutter, because ala yayin yichyot, they needed wine. So they think that they're not doing an aveira, but they know that in Poland the water is not polluted. And don't, if they would live in Poland, they would observe the din, they wouldn't drink goyisha wine. The Rambam says that that's not considered achoshel al adov. So So the conservative rabbinate quoted this Tshuvas Ramah that it's permissible to drink Stam Yenam. The Ramah never said it's permissible. Ramah says that the Cheshbon is incorrect. He just justifies it. He's explaining why they think that they're not in violation of an Issa. But it really is an Issa. But the Italian wine that we're drinking tonight has Tshuvas Halacha Lamaisa on it. From all of the Rabbonim in Italy that we were speaking about and those I didn't speak about, the one who I was most influenced, I think most people are most influenced by the Chidor. Chidor's name was Chaim Yosef David Azulai. He was not a Kohen. He quotes in one of his Svarim that people thought that the family name Azulai is a Rosh HaTevis Isha Zayna V'chavol Lo Yikochu. A Kohen is not permitted to marry a Zayna or a Chavol. So he quotes such an opinion that the name Azulai is unique to Kohanim. I remember years ago, 40 years ago, there was a student of Mayu whose name was Azulai. So I asked him, is that what the name means? He said, no, it's a Goyish name. They're non-Jews that have the name Azulai. It has nothing to do with Isha Zayim Chavavulai Koh. So there was a great Goyin. He lived, he was born around 1720 or so, 1730. He lived into the early of the 1800s. He was not born in Italy, he was born in Yerushalayim. I saw some of this one, they when they quote from the Chidor, Chaim Yosef David Azulai, so they quote Samach Tes, Svari Tahar. I'm not sure what that expression Svari Tahar means, because in the history books they quote that the Chidor's mother was a real Ashkenaziya. She was a descendant of the Prisha, of the Smat. That's real, you can't become more Ashkenazi than that. So is he considered a Svardi Tahor? His father was a Svardi, but his mother was a real Ashkenazi. Yes, I don't know why they call that a Svardi Tahor. I'm not sure when they apply that appellation. But the Chidor wrote, the Chidor lived to the age of 83, and he wrote 83 Svarim. And they're not overlap. Each Sefer is a totally different Sefer, nothing to do with each other. So the Chidor is the one who most influenced me. From all of the Rabbonim in Italy, he was the one who had more influence than anybody else. When I was in high school, my family lived in the Bronx, and I used to go by bus to yeshiva every day. So I couldn't take a big sefer to learn on the bus. There wasn't enough room. So my father didn't have too many small svarim. He didn't have too many kapit svarim, pocket svarim. So one of the few kapit svarim, pocket svarim that he had was a little sefer by the Chidor, one of the 83 svarim that he published. The real Svardim have a whole bookcase with all the 83 Svardim by the Chidor. As I say, on Megillah Shrus, on Megillah Sesta, on Megillah Sech, every Kundish has a different Sefer, on Pirkei Avos a different Sefer, on Gemaras, Tshuvas, and a few different encyclopedias. He writes each Sefer is totally different. Not just that he wanted to put out more Svardim, each Sefer is completely different. So he has been quoted in Shulchan Aruch, but the commentaries on the side of the page of Shulchan Aruch so many times that from all of the Rabbonim in Italy, he has had more of an influence on all the people who learn in yeshivas than all of the others. He lived in Italy many, many years, and he visited, apparently in the city Parma, there was a tremendous library that belonged to the government. So they had Kisveya, they had manuscripts of the Meiris. The Meiri didn't live in Italy. The Meiri lived in Parpignan, in southern France. And the Chidor visited the library, the royal library in Parma, and he read through, he must have been a very quick reader, he read through all the Meiris. Whenever he found a Chiddush, every 10th page, he would copy it over and write it in one of his Svarim. Now we have all the Meiris are printed. But before they printed all of the Meiris, the Meiris were printed in the last 80 years or so. They started printing, now they printed many. But before then, nothing was printed. So the Chidor was the one who would quote. Whenever the Meiri had a Chiddush, he would quote it. So he has had quite an influence on Halacha. One of the issues that comes up, I know if a person has mudadik mezuzahs, he spent $150 for each mezuzah. Then he's got to move to a different house.
once the use his mezuzah. So there's a din, you have to leave the mezuzah on the house if the next tenant is going to be a Jew. I have to leave the $150 mezuzahs on the house? Can I exchange them and put kosher mezuzahs, not like mahajim and a mahajim, it'd be only $50. Is that permissible? So the chidor is quoted in the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. You're not allowed to switch them. You have to leave the mehudadik and mezuzahs on the door. So I live in Washington Heights. So they say, Rabbi Broya Paskin against the chidor. He said, as long as you leave kosher mezuzahs, you can take down your mehudadik and mezuzahs, $150 mezuzahs. If you plan to put them on your new apartment, to take down a mezuzah, that it shouldn't function at all as a mitzvah, that's not proper. It's a rachmanis on the mezuzah, it was serving part of a mitzvah. But if you go to need all the mezuzahs that you have in your house, you're going to put them on your new apartment, on your new house, and you're going to leave kosher mezuzahs on the old house. They're not going to be worth $150. So he paskin against the Birkei Yosef. Birkei Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Chidor. Chidor has, let's say, a lot of people make Kiddush on Shabbos morning, then they have cake. So they ate a kazais of cake, so they're going to say Allah Micha, but they didn't drink a revius of wine. So there's a question, how much wine do you have to drink in order to recite the bracha achrayna Allah Gevin? So there's one opinion, kazais, one opinion, lalugmo, which is a revius, and one opinion, a revius. And Shulchan Aruch, they recommend that you shouldn't drink in between a kazais and a revius, you shouldn't drink. It's got to be a sophic bracha. So what if you ate cake kishir? So you're going to say ala michya anyway. So is it okay to add on a line in the middle of ala michya, ala gefen, rapia gefen also? To say ala gefen separately for wine, if it's less than a shir, that's questionable. But you're saying the bracha achrayna anyway, because you had a kishir of cake. Then you want to add ala gefen, rapia gefen. So the chidor says you're not allowed to. So Rav Moshe Feinstein disagrees. We usually follow Rav Moshe Feinstein on this issue. But I think the Chidor, more so than all the other Gedolim who lived in Italy, he wrote 83 Svarim. So we have read more from his Svarim than from all of the others. I'll just close with one of the dinim that people ask me a lot of times. I remember when I was in high school and I was traveling every day by bus to the yeshiva, I used to read this little sefer by the Chidor who had like kids of Shulchan Aruch. He had everything has Piske Halacha, Likud, the Piske Halacha. So he says, the Gemara says, when you're about to daven Shemoneh Esrei, you should approach HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you should walk three steps ahead. What if you're standing next to the wall? So there's nowhere to walk three steps ahead, nowhere to walk. So in Lithuania, they developed a minhag that the Aruch HaShulchan quotes, that you walk back three steps, in order to be able to walk forward three steps. But the Chidor says, where he comes from, they didn't have such a minhag. If you're ready next to the wall, so there's nowhere to walk three steps, they just say Shemoneh Esrei, where you are. But because I read that as a child, before I ever looked in it, before I ever dreamt of looking in an Aruch HaShulchan, so that's the practice that I follow. We have a lot of things from the Chidor that we follow, because they're quoted by the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. The Italian Rabbonim contributed a lot to Halacha. Each one contributed. We mentioned yesterday the Rambam Yifan was set up the Slichas on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur the Slichas. The other Gedolim set up different things. But the Birkei Yosef, the Chidor, is the one who had more influence than all of the others. Good evening, everyone. Oh,
that's it. Dessert is being served.
Okay, dessert is being served.